Andy Burnham, and welcome to Sparks. Well, this week, our second report from the recent Hi-Fi show. Radio Fax presenter from 1988, Holly, returns from Nepal with some stories. News about the independent national radio franchise. An interview with Bruce Gingell, head of the most profitable TV company in Britain, TVAM. A feature on fuzzy logic, and something to try if you have a spare computer network or two. With, of course, your letters. This is Sparks, each and every week on Radio Fax. To the microphone after 3 years, here's Holly.
In the Sunday Review, Lynn Barber interviews Bruce Gingell, who's presently head of TVAM. In fact, it was in 1985 that TVAM was losing £500,000 a week. Now it's the most profitable television company in Britain. And why? Because of Bruce Gingell. Bruce puts his faith in positive energy and group consciousness. in trampolining, cranky diets and pastel shades. It's won him the ratings, but will it win him the franchise? If it doesn't, it's my guess he'll probably cry. This was the interview that had everything. Tea, tears, massage, trampolining, even a couple of free watches for my children. Everyone at TVAM said Bruce Gyngell was charming, but gosh, it was like being licked all over by fairy tongues. The most exquisite moment came when he called his secretary and said, "Christabel, where is my vision?" Christabel, wearing an inscrutable expression, as well she might, rummaged in his desk drawer and produced a single sheet of typed paper. It said as follows, "The purpose of my life is to serve. I am a special and unique person. Whatever I've wanted in life, I've received. I want to be a demonstration and a beacon, a person who is happy, successful, joyous, and satisfied. I want TVAM to be the most successful and profitable television company in Britain." "You see," he exclaims triumphantly. "Now look at that date. The date on the vision is the 17th of the 6th, 1985, which means nothing, but no worries. The visionary will soon explain." In 1985, a year after he joined TVAM as managing director, it was insane to think that it could ever be the most profitable television company in Britain. It had barely survived its disastrous launch under the Famous Five and was losing half a million a week. But then he had his vision, and now TVAM has £45 million in the bank and is the most profitable television company in Britain. Bruce Gyngell doesn't look like a visionary. He's Australian, 62, tall, thin, fair-skinned and elegant. You'd never guess that inside that carefully sculpted pink shirt, there beats the heart of a world-class eccentric. I only suspected it by the merest chance. I'd been reviewing the Sunday papers at TVAM on the Frost programme, and the researcher who was showing me out, who was also an old friend, stopped with his hand on the doorknob and said, "Just better polish it a bit." The doorknob bore a decal saying, "TVAM, the winning team for 1993. What on earth was that? Bruce believes, he explained, polishing away, that every time we touch this, we put our energy into it, and so it helps us win the franchise. This was somebody I knew at Oxford, who I believed to have a sense of humour. I just stood there open-mouthed while he polished the doorknob. "Oh yes," Gyngell explained when I went to see him. "Of course he puts decals on the doorknobs for people to touch, to harvest their energy. It's very important that TVAM should win its franchise renewal. They would all be in suspense until October, though Ladbrokes gave them 11 to 10 on. And yes, it was absolutely true that at the staff meeting about the franchise, he burst into tears. He promptly burst into tears again by way of a demonstration. Meanwhile, all employees must put their good vibes into winning the wearing of their TVAM watches and keyrings. He gave me two for my children, and stroking them at all times. Gyngell explains all this in perfectly reasonable tones of describing how a fridge works. "I believe group collective consciousness. I believe in positive energy. And I feel if I can collect the group consciousness of the 400 people that work here and their families, the other applicants haven't got a chance." This is only one of Gyngell's theories. He has colour theories, food theories, body theories. He meditates. He eats microbiotic. He thinks pink. He has a trampoline in his office, which is not just any old trampoline, but a special one devised by NASA. He even made me try it. The reason TVAM looks set to be a garish playgroup is because Gyngell believes pink and yellow cheer viewers up, whereas black and grey depress them. "I set out to make TVAM eternal summer so that all these lost and lonely people would have a place in the world they could turn on and feel warm and bright." He can utter hours of this stuff, and indeed he does. He can chat about Indian ashrams, Japanese dojos, Hong Kong acupuncture parlors, and every conceivable species of Californian encounter group. Underlying all is the belief that you can make yourself what you will, reinvent your body and your mind. I said at one point, when he was banging on about always looking on the bright side, that he sounded like a Christian Scientist, and he said, oh yes, because he was brought up a Catholic, his grandmother had a Christian Scientist maid. But then if I'd said a Rosicrucian or a cargo cultist, he would have probably said, oh yes, to that too. He's nothing if not eclectic. He came to TVAM in 1984, and he was then 55, having done everything in Australian television. After Sydney Grammar School and a spot of university, no degree of course, he became a radio announcer. When Australian television started, he was the first presenter to appear on the screen, and I loved it, he said. I love walking down the street and people recognizing me being the TV star. But in those days, there was no videotape, so I never saw myself. Then one day, we did a program that was pre-recorded, and when I looked at it, I thought, you're not good enough to be on the air. You're never going to be great. I've always had such terribly high standards for myself. So then I moved to management. I thought, I'll move to something I'll be the best in the world at. By 35, he was managing director of Australia's Channel 9. And then from 1972 to 1975, he worked in England as managing director of ATV, and then briefly in Hollywood on the Pink Panther. He likes to claim that his nickname at TVAM is the Pink Panther, although nobody ever calls him that. In 1976, he returned to Australia, became chairman of the Australian Broadcasting Tribunal, and set up its multicultural network, which was dubbed locally WOG Television. But by his mid-50s, he had reached a plateau. He was thus delighted when his friend Kerry Packer said he bought a slice of an ailing British TV company and wanted him to run it. He came originally for 3 years, but will now stay until he retires at 70. In 1986, he divorced his Australian wife and married a young English one, Kathy, and started a new family. Working at TVAM, he says, has been one of the most enjoyable periods of my life. See, the average age of the place is only 27, and the joke is, if Bruce goes home early, it drops to 23. Dissidents say it wasn't really Bruce Gyngell who turned TVAM around, it was Greg Dyke, who's now head of LWT. It was he who changed the format under the Famous Five and brought in Anne Diamond and Lizzie Webb, as well as Roland Ratt. But then Gyngell arrived and Dyke disappeared. What happened to Greg Dyke, Bruce? Greg Dyke? Well, Greg Dyke is Greg Dyke, you know.
We'll continue that fascinating interview later in the programme. Now, hello to Bart Maguire, writing from Belfast. I have been tuning into you quite regularly for the past 6 months. I particularly like the programmes on Monday and Tuesday. I hope you keep this up. Well, we will. Reception is average to good for your signals here in Belfast. All the best back to Bart Maguire. And if you'd like to write a letter to us, we'd love to have one. It's Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranleigh, England, GU67BG. Write and let us know something about yourself and what you do. If you'd like a reply to your letter, which includes a station card, technical information, and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send us 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1. The address is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranleigh, England, GU67BG.
Crying out more. sugar tired. This fire is out of control, yes. It's burning my heart, yeah. Burning my soul, Lord.
Girls had me dancing on the floor.
Girls had me crying out for so confused. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. It's life, you gotta get used to. Don't give up now, love is at your rescue. Come on,
girls had me dancing on the floor. Girls had me crying out.
Radio Authority shows the Independent Television Commission how. Comment from The Independent by Claire Dobby. The Radio Authority, one of the two regulators which took up the responsibilities of the Independent Broadcasting Authority in January, has shown its mettle by refusing to give Showtime Radio extra time to secure the funding of its bid for the national radio franchise. Will the Independent Television Commission, which shares the same building, have as much guts? When First National Radio, the group behind Showtime, put in its £1.75 million a year bid, industry observers thought it had offered too much. Classic FM, which now gets its shot at the franchise, bid over £1 million less. When Showtime failed to come up with its funding, there was a lot of I told you so. The television franchise bidding procedure includes a clause which allows the ITC to fail a bid for not meeting its quality threshold if it thinks a company has offered so much that it cannot fulfil its programme commitments. Phil Redmond's Northwest Television is believed to have bid £35 million for Granada's franchise, while offering more local programming and an inchoate shareholding structure. To fail it would save the ITC the inconvenience of having to decide whether it resorts to the exceptional circumstances rule to save Granada, the makers of Coronation Street and World in Action. More difficult is the situation with two incumbents, TVS, which has announced a bid of £54 million a year,
and TSW, believed to have bid $16 million. Both are based on optimistic assumptions, which analysts believe would involve the companies in losses for years. The ITC knows the facts and figures, and knows what should be done. It is time for George Russell, the Independent Television Commission's chairman, to show he knows what the I in ITC stands for. Comment there from Claire Dobby.
This is Sparks on Radio Fax 6205 and 12255. From Electronics World and Wireless World, prime purpose for 100 computer ring. A pet hobby among mathematicians is to search for ever bigger prime numbers, but while it's easy to test relatively small numbers, it becomes much harder when the number of digits runs into thousands. Imagine the effort trying to divide such a number by every other smaller number. The search for very big prime numbers inevitably takes a lot of time, often months on the biggest computers in the world. And since searching for these numbers has virtually no commercial significance, it is not something that usually rates a very high priority. Mathematicians looking for huge prime numbers start off calculating what are known as Fermat numbers, after the French mathematician, calculated from the formula 2 raised to the power of 2, itself raised to the power of n plus 1. Suffice to say that by the time you reach the seventh number in the Fermat series, it is bigger than the total number of atoms in the known universe. Because of the sheer amount of computing power needed to process these mind-boggling numbers, there is little chance of mathematicians ever being able to obtain enough time on computers with the necessary power. For that reason, Dr. Richard Crandall of NEXT has decided to try a different approach and make use not of one big computer, but of all the spare capacity in some 100 networked workstations around the company offices. A program called Zilia polls all the workstations and repeatedly asks each one if it's free. If yes, then a small piece of prime number calculation is fed along to the workstation, and the answer fed back to a central point. Zilia can make effective use of a workstation even if its owner has abandoned it for only 10 minutes. Of course, if a terminal is used for real business, Zilia can extract the calculation and restore normal working within a few seconds. Crandall says that Zilia has effectively created a supercomputer that costs nothing. It merely makes use of existing capacity that's sitting idle. Already, Zilia has confirmed that the 13th Fermat number is not a prime number. When you consider that F13, as it's called, has about 2,500 digits, the full amount of arithmetic becomes apparent. Zilia is now about to attack F22, which may yield the world's largest known prime number. Richard Crandall reckons it will take about 6 months to find the answer.
The only thing I want is just to rush, push, cash. Thank you. I know you're grown, but keep the beat. You gotta dance with me and me, no feet. I wanna see you dance, you gotta follow me. Please don't let me alone. Make up your mind, I'm not the kind who's gonna use a phone. Nespa. At the machine every day for all my life, I used to do it and I needed it. The only thing I want is just to rush, push, cash.
The Cows and the Country Doctor, a book review of a biography about Edward Jenner by Richard B. Fisher. Smallpox, known to have existed in ancient Egypt, was still endemic in 33 countries in 1967. But when, in 1976, the World Health Organization offered a bounty of $1,000 for a single new case, it found no takers, and the disease was officially pensioned off. The key to this success lay in the international implementation of a vaccination technique to which Edward Jenner's name has adhered, although its use goes back many centuries. Vaccinators have always faced fierce opposition, including satiric odes and comic operas, and it has proved a continuing battle to keep immunization rates high enough to prevent the return of epidemics. The UK's whooping cough scare in the mid-70s, when the vaccine was unfairly blamed for neurological damage, still leads to incorrect advice being given to parents on counterindications. The wrestling match portrayed in a sculpture of Jenner vaccinating his own son is, however, dutifully repeated every day as writhing children are jabbed by doctors who regrettably know little of Jenner himself. In some ways, he was typical of the better end of the 18th century medical trade. A landed country doctor in the Cotswolds, he combined heroic tabletop surgery with a spot of ballooning, poetry, and the occasional unmasking of a poisoner. He turned down the chance of colonial adventure with Captain Cook's second expedition and a medical post in India under Warren Hastings. Instead, he studied under the great John Hunter, whose fascinating correspondence Richard Fisher has exhumed in this fine biography. When not advising on likely bargains in the art market, Hunter set the young Jenner research projects in dissection and differential cultivation. But Jenner's real interest was in the protective effect of cowpox infection against the dreaded smallpox, the speckled monster, King's Evil or Scrofula, which was a major cause of disfigurement, blindness and premature mortality. So seriously was the pox taken in 18th century England that the risky procedure of variolation was often practiced amongst the educated classes. This involved the controlled introduction of scabs or pustular material from smallpox sufferers onto the skin of the unafflicted, so as to give them immunity. Jenner, however, noted the widespread country belief that the much less dangerous illness of cowpox offered protection from smallpox. His pamphlet, An Inquiry into the Causes and Effects of the Variolae Vaccinae, a classic of scientific writing, established the case for immunization by cowpox and devised a means by which it could be transported as far as the Plains Red Indians and the Brahmins of India. Fisher recounts Jenner's sudden rise to international fame as Vaccine Clerk to the World, his own ironic label, and the intrigues in the Royal Jennerian Society. Interestingly, Jenner emerges, unlike his American colleagues, as reluctant to patent his method and only belatedly receiving state support for his discovery. Fisher describes the anti-Jennerians, who alleged high mortality and incomplete protection in the procedure. But one needs to read wider to find the degree of sustained hostility to vaccination, most famously from Shaw, but also from other luminaries. There was certainly a legitimate fear that medical men's enthusiasm might in part be financial. And, oddly enough, since the new contract for general practitioners has once again introduced quite a large financial incentive for doctors, this objection is far from irrelevant today. That review of the book Edward Jenner by Richard B. Fisher by David Widgery in The Independent.
Continuing the Lynn Barber interview with Bruce Gyngell, head of TVAM.
I had a vanity, I suppose, and worked to buy cashmere sports clothes. When I was young, I used to play with this boy whose family was enormously rich and had 6 Rolls Royces and servants. I just knew that was a better way of life than the one we had. I could tell the difference in quality. He also fell in with the Packer family, the Australian publishing moguls, which he told me was probably the single most important influence on his life. He had a friend in the Air Force who suddenly contracted polio and was stuck in an iron lung, and he would go and see him on the way home from work. The young man was related to the Packers. Thereafter, they invited Gyngell to all of their parties. Old Sir Frank Packer dictated that if Bruce ever needed a leg up in his career, he could call on him. What is striking about this story is not so much its content, but the starstruck way in which Gyngell tells it. He really worships the Packers, the same way that some English people worship the royal family. He talks about their houses, lifestyle, servants, in the reverent tones of Hello magazine. Of course, it's a myth that the Australians are classless, but with Gyngell there is more, an almost Gatsby-ish yearning for class. Several people at TVAM told me that Gyngell's attitude to David Frost is strongly coloured by the fact that Frost is a titled wife. Likewise, Gyngell's account of how he met his present wife, press stories hitherto have said he met her when he saw her walk past at TVAM. She was a features editor and exclaimed, "Great pair of knockers, sexist I'd say." But he looked hurt at the notion, and absolutely not. The great pair of knockers had belonged to Eve Pollard, though my wife has a very good pair of knockers, I must say, a very lovely buff. Disgusting. No, he met his wife quite differently. When he joined TVAM, he spent a weekend reading through the personnel files. And as an Antipodean, having this enormous admiration for Oxford and Cambridge, he says, "I was amazed to find a girl who had a double first from Cambridge and a postgraduate degree from Oxford, which is the ultimate in life as far as I'm concerned. So I said, who's this Kathy Rowan? And went round to find her. I thought she was very attractive. I actually thought, it's a dreadful word to use, she was the most refined person here. She had more class than anyone in the organisation. So I vaguely flirted with her and took her out a few times. My wife then sent the 2 children over because she found out they were heroin addicts and couldn't cope. And Kathy's attitude to me changed then because she was so impressed with the compassion and the way I looked after them. Then I talked her into going macrobiotic and we got on enormously well. Before Kathy, there had been a great philanderer. I didn't believe there was a woman in the world I couldn't sleep with if I set my mind to it. But then he realized there was no one as attractive as Kathy. She wanted children. He said, no way. She fell pregnant. He divorced his first wife and married Kathy 4 days before their firstborn son arrived. It's been marvelous, a wonderful relationship. I don't know that I've ever had that sense of unconditional love before. My mother was a conditional lover. I feel more loved, his eyes fill with tears yet again, than I ever have in my entire life, and that gives me an incredible sense of responsibility. I suppose I was chauvinistic until I met Kathy. To meet a woman you could enjoy talking to. She was so bright and clever at dinner parties. I'm just so proud. Kathy saw him through his heart attack and his bitterness afterwards. He had done everything right, microbiotics, jogging, meditation. I just couldn't believe it could happen to me. And I was really quite annoyed that I didn't die. I thought, why didn't I go on to the next incarnation? I put it to him that all this fidgety searching for new philosophies must stem from a belief there was something wrong with him. Oh, no, no, no. I don't think there's anything wrong with me. But I have come to believe that I'm the best Bruce Gyngell that there is. But I think there's a wonderment out there, and I want to ensure that I'm fulfilling myself. It's revelation I'm interested in. You see, I once thought, I had this vision, that I was going to be a sort of Moses. When I meditated, I had this strong visual image of me in a long white robe and white hair, surrounded by a flock of people. And then I'd come round to think, what people? How am I going to get this flock? And then it came to me, I thought, wait a minute, I've got 400 people here now at TV AM. This is my opportunity, my chance to give people some joy and some happiness in their lives and to lead them into a greater sense of fulfillment. So this is what I try to do, and that's when I wrote down my vision. Despite all this talk of joy and happiness, there are those at TVAM who might maintain that he can be a brute of a boss. Indeed, even while he was denying it to me, he was simultaneously giving his secretary a hard time for making our tea too strong. Thus, sometimes you've got to sting people. I remember when I was in Japan and did a dojo. We had to sit like this, he kneels on his heels, for 2 hours without moving. And if you flinched, that's still too strong, sweetheart, go and get some more water. They used to hit you with a cane. But the tension, the sting, would make you relax and then you'd be fine. So I often see myself as stinging people into action. And the secretary, sufficiently stung, returns at last with tea, which is to his liking. But how much did he sing? Say, Anne Diamond. She was, you may recall, TVAM's saviour during the time of the strike, whizzing round the world on her sofa to bring programmes from unlikely places. Then suddenly she was suing TVAM for a breach of contract. What happened? Ginger looks weary. I liked Anne. I thought she was fantastic on television, but it finally became evident that she didn't want to be on breakfast TV. I gave her 3 months off on full pay to have her first child and 6 months off for the second, which doesn't sound so terribly hard. But I was concerned when she didn't marry Mike Hollingsworth, the children's father. We do continual tracking studies of our presenters, and Anne had one of the highest popularities ever. But when she had the first child, it zoomed down. And when she had the second, still unmarried, her popularity descended to the lowest level of anyone that we'd ever employed. The public are basically very moral, and I was concerned about it. I still admire Anne, but when I found out that her boyfriend had registered a company called Good Morning Britain, certainly then my concern and interest in Anne Diamond were diminished. There was an icy tone, a hardness to this speech, which contrasts uneasily with all the tears and sentiment when he was talking about his wife. As head of TVAM, which is, after all, his job, he believes in very hard facts and figures, constant audit reference, and constant budgetary controls. He knows everything there is to know about getting pictures cheaply from around the world. He knows where there is a satellite uplink or where you can hire local crews. He can guess what any given item can cost. Often, when an idea is mooted, he'll say off the top of his head, but that'll cost 150 grand. And the money men will go away with their calculators and work out that it will actually cost precisely £149,267. These are not details he mentions in his vision, but they are details which make him the successful head of TVAM. In fact, running a successful television station is probably so easy for him and so unglamorous that he prefers to talk about almost anything else. Hence his eagerness to chat to me for hours about Eastern religions and microbiotics, even though he must have known I would have taken the mickey. Such subjects are, by the way, of being a smokescreen. They're not really what he's about. What he's really about is television. He first saw it in America when he was 23. I went to the Columbia president's office and there was a television set in the reception outside and I switched it on and I sat there and thought, I found what I'm going to be great at. This is my career. I knew it instantaneously. So what if it is what he's great at? What does it amount to? What do you see when you switch on the TVAM? Well, unless it's David Frost or Mayer even, What you will see is two staggeringly ordinary people sitting on garish sofas exchanging banalities. Days, months, years of Gingell have gone into choosing those particularly ordinary people. The bloke will be classless with some faintly regional accent. He will look about 40, not too thin, not too handsome, certainly not too clever. Gingell believes, perhaps uniquely, that Mike Morris is the best television presenter in Britain. The Sheila will be a decade younger, mildly pretty, but not too pretty, chirpy rather than bright. Both will be wearing pastel shades. You can well believe that between them, they know absolutely everything there is to be known about patio furniture. What you cannot believe is that they will ever discuss Ayurvedic principles or reincarnation. In other words, there's a gap between what Gingell claims to be interested in and what he actually produces. It's like the difference between the man who chooses his wife for her Oxford refinement and the one who chooses her for a great knockers. His best friend is Kerry Packer. Does he chat to Kerry Packer about Ayurvedic principles? No. We mainly discuss business. Quite.
You're considering buying one of the Philips DC777 shortwave car radios from Radio Fact Sales? Here's some very good news for you. After some hard bargaining with our suppliers, we're now able to offer these terrific shortwave car radios at the new lower price of only £239. And remember, not only is the DC777 a good quality digital readout shortwave tuner, it also has long wave, medium wave, FM stereo, a high quality stereo cassette deck and powerful stereo amplifier, all in a compact standard size in car unit. Shortwave coverage is from 3170 to 21910 kilohertz continuous. This unit receives a good review in the World Radio and TV Handbook and 4 stars in the Radio Netherland receiver shopping list. The new low price, remember, is only £239, inclusive of VAT and delivery in the UK or overseas airmail to anywhere in the world. There's no longer wait for your unit to arrive. We hold them in stock. Contact our sales office for more information and a brochure. Telephone number is in England. 0483 275 997. Fax number is also in England. 0483 276 477. Or write to us at Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, GU6 7BG in England.
Now our second report from the recent Hi-Fi show.
Onto the Nakamichi stand and a cassette deck that's an old favourite of mine.
The cassette, when it wants to auto-reverse, flips completely out, comes out about 4 inches, and the entire cassette flips round and back in, which still to this day amazes me. The Nakamichi Tuner 2, which features matched twin varicap diode front end and a low distortion RF stage with low noise FETs and ceramic resonators. It's an FM only, it's got a digital readout with presets, and it's also got a mechanical tuning where you turn and there's a clicking feel. My only complaint about that is you have to turn it very fast to go fast. Some of these manual tuners, the faster you turn, the faster it skips, but you really have to wind this round and round and round to get to the other end of the dial. So Nakamichi has the 1000 DAT, which is in 2 boxes, rack mounting, and unusually, I think, silver. This is trying to lead the way in new colouring, do you think?
No. It's our highest end, that's why we want to differentiate. We always do things in black, and this is to try differentiating as much as possible.
So take me through some of the features.
A normal DAT has a loading time of about 6 to 9 seconds.
Yeah.
Here, 1.9 seconds.
Amazing. It's more in common with a video recorder, really, than a cassette
exactly.
player.
And normal DAT has two tape guides, which also happen to be the loading pins.
Uh-huh.
But in this system, the band is loaded into a separate block on each side, so the guidance of the tape is independent from these movable pins.
I see.
And so the azimuth is much more accurate.
notable feature of that DAT player is connected to it the digital interface system, which has very interesting ergonomic styling. The knobs are tapered towards the front and they resemble silver nipples. Prince playing on a very small pair of B&W speakers, the DM600s, with about a 4-inch diameter driver. And what's amazing me is the actual cable that's feeding them, because it's bi-wired, meaning there's one set of cables feeding the bass and another set of cables feeding the treble unit, which is about an inch across dome tweeter. However, to feed each of these, there's about quarter of an inch diameter of presumably monofiber copper cable, and feeding a tiny 1-inch tweeter through that sort of cable strikes me as a little excessive. Here's rather an interesting cutaway of a speaker taller than myself, over 6 foot. There's about a 12-inch driver at the top and a 12-inch driver at the bottom. In between 3-inch mid-ranges and a couple of, I think, two tweeters, this is their top-of-the-range module with advanced fluid-cooled metal dome tweeter and Kevlar mid-range units and polymer cone base drivers, fully tri-wireable with gold terminals and with a power handling of 800 watts.
More from the Hi-Fi show in a moment, but first, hello to Matthew Searle, who writes from Tadley in Basingstoke. I have enjoyed your station for the past 6 months and have been intending to write since the start. The technical features are excellent, but the occasional features on offshore stations from the past are best. I find the music stations on FM very tedious. Caroline had a poor signal but was immensely addictive. I often follow world events using a shortwave radio, the coup in Moscow and the problems in Yugoslavia being examples. He listens on a low HF125 with a long wire. I try and listen every other evening and appreciate the hard work of keeping Radio Fax going. Many thanks, Matthew Searle.
Deep inside we knew our love was true for a while. We paid no mind to the past. We knew love would last every night. Something right would invite us to begin the day.
So back to the Hi-Fi Show.
This is the Dynavector stand, sound by Super Stereo. And the Super Stereo creates two more channels on small speakers for the rear. Yes. So what different environments can you have with it?
This is normal stereo.
Yeah.
This position is close to the stage. And this position is rather medium-sized concert hall. Or the middle positions of the concert hall. And this is much larger space.
This is church. This is probably the most impressive one. Yeah. Can we stop the CD? Yeah. I just wanted to hear how it faded out, as how the sort of how the reverberance dies away.
That's what I was. Yeah, you can hear.
The AMC remote control system. Can you take me through the features? It can control speakers in a number of different rooms. Yep. If you look at this one.
What you can do with the S84 is over four rooms, you can have eight different inputs, audio or visual inputs, and then each room can select its either CD or tape and listen to whichever one they want to in that room.
And through the remote control?
Via the remote control. A wall sensor in each room will then relay the codes back from the remote control to the hi-fi system. So you can operate the whole hi-fi system from another room.
Two products there. The second one sounds rather useful. The first one, well, I wasn't that convinced. It sounded rather like a load of reverb being added to the signal, but quite an interesting effect.
Next, an item from the BBC Radio 2 Arts programme with Sheridan Morley. Here, Peter Fiddick is talking, first of all, about the independent national radio franchise, which was awarded to Showtime Radio. They have subsequently failed to raise the necessary amount of money.
As much as the other two bidders put together. And they say that they were sure that the franchise could be profitable on that basis. They were going to spend several hundred thousand pounds on what they call quality programming and that this was necessary. But clearly they couldn't convince enough city backers, merchant bankers of this.
So now as this weird kind of handicap system works, the focus now passes to the second contender, which is going to be a classic operation.
Yes, Classic FM have been around this area for a very long time. They bid for one of the London stations and were widely expected to get it, but didn't. That's the one that went to Jazz FM, in which they now have an interest. And because theirs was just, by a whisker, the second highest of the three bids, then it automatically is awarded to them. They now also have until the end of this month to show that they can get their act together. But given the smaller amounts of money involved and the fact they've been around for quite a long time as a group, I would expect to see them do that.
Now, assuming they do raise the money and get the contract, what that means in BBC terms from the competition is that the pressure is off Radio 2 but onto Radio 3.
Yes, for the listener and indeed for the BBC and the rest of the competition, it just changes the nature of the ball game altogether from having another apparently highly funded popular music programme. You then have the middle of the road, I think is the way it may reasonably pitched, classical music. The popular classical music is what Classic FM have always been talked about, not as rigorous as Radio 3, and of course by no means as wide-ranging for the classical music lover. But that will come on air presumably in sometime in the second half of next year. And could very well give the BBC breathing space in terms of its popular programming and at the same time raise the questions that it's already asking itself about quite how Radio 3 develops.
And turning back to television, under this same economic handicap system, all kinds of rumours about the major companies losing their franchises. Is it really sensible to put this whole thing up to auction and to have a system whereby you can simply lose on the grounds of how much money you have bid and then failed to raise?
Well, of course, I think not. And a lot of others have come to that conclusion, including, I recently heard, it is said that Mrs. Thatcher herself, out of office, has actually remarked some senior ITV figures over dinner that perhaps we made a mistake with that one.
Indeed, that may well be true. Peter Fiddick talking there about the future for television and radio. We turn now to the classic.
And that was from the arts programme with Sheridan Morley on BBC Radio 2. So with only three bidders, one of whom has collapsed for the Independent National Radio FM channel, what chances for the AM? There are two national AM services going to be advertised, the first one of which the BBC gets rid of their worst frequency, 1215 kHz, which is used for the Radio 3. And the Radio 1 frequencies are slightly more desirable, so slightly more expensive to run, 1053 and 1089 kHz, will go to the last of the national INR franchises.
Shows that's left through. Time's up. I'm sorry I kept you thinking of this. You keep repeating your miss. The rhyme from the microphone solo with. So you sit by the radio hand on the dial soon. As you hear it, pump up the volume. Dance with the speaker till you hear it blow. Then plug in a headphone, cause here it goes. Word when it's heard to control your body to dance. So dot text the tempo like a red alert. Reaches your reflex and let it work. When this is playing, you can't get stuck with the steps. So can say, and I'ma still come up with a gift to be swift. Follow the leader, the rhyme will go deaf with the record that was mixed a long time ago. It could be done, but only I could do it. For those that can dance and clap your hands to it. I start to think, and then I sink into the paper like I was ink. When I'm writing, I'm trapped in between the line. I escape. When I finish the rhyme, I got soul, 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 soul. Like this might tempt me to pose, show my rings in my fat gold chain. Grab the mic like I'm on Soul Train, but I wait, cause I master this. Let the others go first so the brothers don't miss. Eric B. break the sticks.
You got it!
Rock him will begin when you make the mix. I'll experiment like a scientist. You wanna rhyme? You gotta sign my list. Cause I'm a manifest and bless the mic I'll hold. You want an X? Then you gotta have soul. Who can't say my name? First of all, I'm the soloist, the soul controller. Rock him, get stronger as I get older. Constant elevation, cause expansion. I write my rhymes while I cool in my mansion. Then put it on tape and in the city I test it. Then on the radio, the R's requested. You listen to it, the concept might break you. Cause almost anyone can relate to. Whoever's out of hand, I'ma give them handles. Light them up, blow them out like candles. Or should I just let them out? To give them a hand so they can see how I felt. Just cause I rock gold, rock cameras on the mic. And you know I got soul. Time to get on up. Now feel from uptown, Brooklyn bound, the Bronx, Queens, or Long Island Sound. Even other states come right exact. It ain't where you're from, it's where you're at. Since you came here, you have to show and prove. And do that dance until it don't move. That's all you need is soul, self-esteem, and release. The
rest is up to you. Rock him or say peace.
The success story continues. New records are created.
What do you think of that disc, Marina? Isn't it terrific?
Fuzzy Logic finds a home. The technology is giving new capabilities to a wide range of consumer products. Douglas Kaplan and Betty Ann Tinnelly writing in Electronic World News. It took 2 decades for Fuzzy Logic to move out of the lab and into consumer products. Now Japanese engineers use Fuzzy Logic as a form of intelligent control that makes decisions based on approximations instead of hard binary numbers. They are creating self-adjusting vacuum cleaners, air conditioners, televisions, stereos and washing machines. And engineers worldwide are dreaming up new applications for embedded fuzzy control systems that greatly expand the scope of decision-making features for consumers. We have the technology to do a lot, but the real question is how much do people want their machines to do for them, said Yoshihiro Fujiwara, director of the Central Research Laboratory at Matsushita. In some cases, more powerful fuzzy logic systems are needed to help insulate users from the growing complexity of consumer products, said Kiyosho Fukushima, manager at Sanyo. Everything must be considered into a comprehensive form that requires little memorization in order for a consumer to truly enjoy his machine. Because of fuzzy logic, the sophistication level of consumer products in Japan has increased sharply, while the complexity of products has decreased, said Steve O'Hara, senior technical advisor at the US Technology Consortium Microelectronics and Computer Technology Corps. Last summer, MCC formed an international effort to promote the creation of international standards in fuzzy logic systems and software. Although Fuzzy Logic was created in the mid-1960s by Lofty Zadeh, a professor at the University of California at Berkeley, the technology was virtually ignored by the US electronics industry. Because US engineers don't like theories that cannot be scientifically proven, they did not pay attention until the effectiveness was proven in Japan. The race is on to greatly expand the capabilities of embedded fuzzy control in consumer products. A key development area involves combining fuzzy logic with neural networks. The work involves setting up neural net rules on mini-computer systems, testing incoming data from sensors as being either correct or incorrect, true and false conditions. With fuzzy logic, systems are then given the ability to act on conditions, namely making if-then inferences. These fuzzy neural control systems could be self-adaptive, teaching themselves, Fujiwara said. A home system could use a combination of sight, smell, sound and weight through sensors in a kitchen to assist a cook in preparing a meal. Technically, many of the functions are possible, but cost and system size limitations must be addressed before they can be introduced in consumer markets. One example of such a system is a fuzzy-based home cleaning robot, which was developed in the United States by Panasonic. Some vacuum cleaners have used fuzzy logic to automatically adjust suction power for different cleaning surfaces. But the Panasonic robot goes further. It uses fuzzy logic to avoid obstacles and while cleaning a room. There's also fuzzy logic attacking hi-fi. JVC have teamed up with Sanyo to bring out a hi-fi compact component named the Mezzo F7. It employs fuzzy logic control for recording. This is the first hi-fi system equipped with a fuzzy logic CD recording feature, says Hikorov Jakorova of JVC. Pushing a fuzzy logic sensor button causes the audio system to play back a compact disc at 60 times speed and take in from the disc all the data related to the sound level distribution patterns, as well as the peak level frequencies. By applying the fuzzy logic theory to the data, the system understands a genre of music recorded on a CD and automatically sets the recording level in a tape deck at the most well-balanced optimum sound level. It is as if a professional recording engineer had made the recording, according to Kogura. I must say that most new audio systems on the market, including ours, have too many bells and whistles, Kagura said. But the ultimate role we expect the fuzzy logic to play in our audio system is to provide the simplest solution and the easiest operation for every consumer. From Electronic World News, a quick look at fuzzy logic.
Available now, a brand new Radio Caroline CD called The Legend Lives On. The CD contains 44 tracks taking you through some of the great events of Radio Caroline from the first broadcasts in 1964 with Simon D. Test transmissions from Caroline North with Daffy Don Allen. Tony Prince in 1966. Other great names like Robbie Dale, Crispian St. John, Andy Archer and Peter Chicago. One track features the female DJs through the 80s. And you'll hear too, memorable Caroline commercials and jingles, and about the collapse of the highest shipborne aerial mast anywhere in the world in 1987, plus shortwave test transmissions in 89 and the raid in that year on the Ross Revenge. All this is just a tiny fraction of what you'll hear on The Legend Lives On, a new 44-track CD available at £9.99 inclusive, only from these sources. SMC, P.O. Box 53121 at 1007 RC Amsterdam in the Netherlands, and from Chris Edwards, P.O. Box 1514, London W72LL in England. Radio Caroline, the legend lives on.
Remember Holly Robson, who did a lot of programs on this station in 1988. Last year, she went to Nepal to work for Voluntary Service Overseas, doing earthquake reconstruction work. Well, she's been back in England for a few weeks' holiday this summer, and I dragged her into the studio to talk to her about life, the universe and everything, but in particular for this programme, about the broadcast media in Nepal. Go on then, Holly, tell us about life in Kathmandu and Nepal.
Now, how many years have you got, Trevor?
Yeah, well, I don't want to know about that, really. Tell us about television in
Have got television out there. Very basic television. It runs for about 5 hours a day, a couple of hours in the morning, and maybe about 3 hours in the evening. Pretty basic, I would say, by our standards.
Colour or black and white?
Yes, they've got colour. They haven't quite got round to sort of putting their sets together in very tasteful sort of arrangements at the moment, but they've got the idea of colour.
And how many people watch it?
Very few, really only those that can afford the television. It's although it is actually available nationwide, there is one transmitting station in Singhadurba, which is in the centre of Kathmandu.
Is this on the hill?
No, it's not, funny enough. It's smack bang in the middle of the Kathmandu Valley, which could probably account for the poor reception in most areas, other than in the valley itself.
And what about radio?
Radio? Yes, radio is a lot more popular.
One station or more?
Just the one, Radio Nepal. But most villages will actually have a radio, probably one per village. It's a very... well, as you probably know, it's sort of full of Himalayas and stuff like that, so most places are really quite difficult to reach. But you'll find in most villages that you go to that somebody will have a radio, and his house and his radio will be the focal point for news from outside their own immediate area.
So if you go some distance to a village that's over one of the mountains, what do they use for a radio? They're picking up the shortwave signal, presumably.
What do you mean, what do they use?
Have you still got radio when you go over a mountain to a village?
Oh, yes,
they can still pick up the station?
Yeah, yes, they can.
But no television in the villages?
No.
That's purely in Kathmandu?
That's right. I mean, all the radios in the villages are battery-operated. I mean, electricity hasn't really reached many places in Nepal. Kathmandu pertains to have electricity. But unfortunately, you'll find that, especially if you're a computer boffin, that it's a bit of a waste of time because there are so many power cuts during the course of a day. But certainly over Nepal in general, there's very little electricity.
So is there a special effort made to keep the electricity on during the hours that a television station's on the air?
Well, no, really. There's no special efforts with anything much in Nepal. Electricity, I would say, being least of the efforts made.
And they're very professional, aren't they?
They try hard. No, they are... I'm just trying to think of what I can compare it to. I could hardly say it was... television and radio presentation standards would be comparable to, say, ours were in the 50s, because although they try hard, they kind of lack that British professionalism that comes over so strongly in our country.
What programmes are on the television? Is it imports or local stuff?
It's all local, and of course, because it's a developing country, most of the programmes are dedicated to health and to agricultural techniques. It's very much, I suppose in that respect, it is quite similar to our radio and TV in the 50s. It's message, it's all for messages as opposed to for entertainment. So how to, best way of planting rice this year perhaps, or something like that is the general content of the...
So there's no running of American films or
There is one radio program that you could describe as being a Nepali archers program, which is quite funny. It's quite a lot of crying and terribly heart-rending episodes that take place, usually that the husband is leaving the wife because he's taken up with another wife, or he's taken another wife into the house and she doesn't know about it, or something like that.
Of course this goes on there.
Yes, that's right. It's certainly quite common to have two or more wives.
Mm-hmm.
Although it's actually quite practical, because you need more than one woman to run your home. If you sort of take into account that most of Nepal is subsistence farming. One man and one wife aren't really quite enough to keep the old homestead together.
So you need at least two wives.
You need at least two wives, yes. Unfortunately, it doesn't work the other way around. So but then, as we all know, women tend to do most of the work over most of the world, Trevor. So
you won't be staying there. Now say something in Nepali.
Just put me on the stop.
Go on, say station ID for our listeners in Nepal.
Hami Radio Nepal Bata Boldai Chu.
Well, Holly there, giving me some details about radio and television and some of the intriguing domestic arrangements in Nepal.
Sparks on Radio Fax 6205 and 12255 every Monday and Tuesday, our weekly programme of technical news and features. Other Radio Fax programmes start on Wednesdays, Fridays and Sundays. Here's a nice letter from someone in Moscow. You may be interested to learn that the DC-777 is a complete success in Moscow, he writes. The world service comes through very well. During the recent events here, it was a real asset to be able to keep in touch with developments. Many thanks for your excellent service. We'd better not say who he is, but he works for the British government. I'm looking forward to receiving your letter. The address is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. If you'd like a reply, which includes a station card, technical information, and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1. Our address, Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. And whether you send the money or not, you will always get a mention on this programme.
Is there anybody out there?
there. Is there anybody out there?
Sparks This Week is presented by Andy Burnham, Holly Robson and Trevor Brook. And here is Trevor with something about the golden age of pirate radio.
Yes, that's right. Here's something from our answer line.
This is David Hassan from Northern Telecom Europe, the Athletic and Social Club, inviting people that on Saturday, October the 19th, held at my factory, we've got the golden age of pirate radio. It's a mini sort of Blackpool come London pirate radio get-together. We have tickets on sale at just £5. If people want to buy tickets, can they please write to myself, care of David Hudson, care of the Athletic and Social Club, Northern Telecom, Chester Hall Lane, Basildon, Essex. Or they can phone me at my home number at 0268 557830. After 7 p.m, please. Don't forget, it's the Golden Age of Pirate Radio, Saturday, October the 19th, at Northern Telecom's factory in Basildon, Essex, presented by the Radio and TV Appreciation section of the Athletic and Social Club.
So, the Golden Age of Pirate Radio. Events happening on the day, according to the timetable. Opening words by the Radio and TV Appreciation section. A look at the past years of pirate radio. Who's who? From the people here today, we say hello to the many that are here from the world of pirate radio. Film fun, lots of films, videos showing the pirate radio years. And then an afternoon guest, tea time, quiz time. And between 6 and 8 o'clock, have a walk around, a look at our great pirate radio sales and offers, plus lots more. And the Golden Age of Pirate Radio Discotheque from 8 o'clock with two great bars plus food snacks. So again, the person to contact is D. Hudson on 0268 557830. 0268 557830 for that event in Basildon. And please remember, tickets must be ordered and will not be on sale on the day. Coming next week in Sparks, an exclusive interview with Peter Chicago of Radio North Sea and then subsequently Radio Caroline, the man who put together the engineering on the Ross Revenge, the highest shipborne aerial mast and the transmitting equipment on that vessel in 1983.